This is an interview with William Dove. Today is August 28th, 2013. We are on the 11th floor of McArdle Laboratory, and I'm Molly Loss. So, Dr. Dove, I'd like to begin by you telling me about where you were born and to tell me a little bit about your family.
Good. So, I'd like to give a timeline along which I'll give some highlights. As I said at the beginning of this oral history, this is all fiction, and that this is the way I synthesize things as of August 2013. And of course, I'm giving a positive spin on it. Doesn't mean it doesn't have some real tragedies in the family that have been important. But anyway, this is the spin I put on my timeline. So I spent the first 9 years of my life in the state of Maine. My father was in charge of a research, agricultural research station at the university. My mother was an intellectual as well. Had gotten a degree in English from Ohio Wesleyan University and then a master's degree from Smith and was given a faculty position at the University of Maine. So that's where they met. In that day and age, it wasn't allowed for two married people to be on the same faculty, so my father continued on that faculty, whereas my mother then stayed at home and in Maine had four children, and then when our family moved to suburban Chicago had our fifth child. So I was one of five children born between 1935 and 1946.
May I ask you which university your parents?
This is the University of Maine in Orono. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Orono was a quite small town, much smaller than Madison. We lived on the edge of town and had a 5-acre plot in which the forest, the way I saw it, I could walk out in the forest and get all the way to Canada if I wanted to without seeing anybody. So it felt like wilderness to me. And I remember with a friend, I built a cabin when I was 8 years old that gave me the kind of freedom that I continue to enjoy. And I feel I learned most outdoors, observing nature and running through the woods and having friends who would like to explore the outdoors. I did go to school, it's true. I rode my bicycle to school from, I think, certainly by second grade, I was riding my bicycle to school, fixing my own bicycle. So a very self-reliant childhood that I lived. I didn't learn much in school. So there came one tragedy. When my father lost his position, and there we were in 1943, four children at home, and he had to look for another job and had to travel around the country trying to get another job. And so my elder sister and I were sent away to an aunt and uncle living in New Jersey. Mm. 1943, I was in third grade, or second grade. And I then continued in third grade to the following year. Went back to Maine in the summer. So up to that point, I say I had learned most just on exploring the outdoors and not really being excited about going to school. But in Montclair, New Jersey, where my aunt and uncle lived, there were some excellent schools. This is true of a lot of the suburban parts of this country, suburban New York, suburban Chicago, suburban Los Angeles. The suburbs have some excellent schools, and I had a third grade teacher who wisely recognized how interested I was in nature, but gave me a book on evolution, which I could then explore by reading, learning something about how the creatures that I enjoyed, how they had evolved over time and what they had, where they had come from. So that turned me from being an outdoors person, outdoors learner, to being a book learner. And both in New Jersey and then when my father did find a job in Chicago, we settled in Oak Park, a suburb of Chicago, which again has excellent schools, and I became a very avid student. So here came on this timeline another tragedy. My father lost his job, in both cases by basically refusing to obey commands that were given to him. And at that point, he was working for the Quartermaster Corps, a branch of the U.S. Army, and you don't disobey orders in the Army. But he lost his job for the second time in 1948. And so my mother supported the family from then on. So I had to make my own spending money, and I did that by delivering newspapers. I was a newspaper boy in the days when I was 12 at the time, when kids younger than 18 could deliver newspapers. Nowadays in Madison, you have to be an adult to deliver newspapers, but then I could deliver newspapers and collect from all of my customers and do a good job. And so that tragedy, and if you like, my way I responded to it by making my own spending money, led to two things. As a high schooler, you know, a boy, a teenage boy, adolescent boy, can do much better at making friends if he does some sports. And so I used some of the money I made delivering newspapers to join a tennis club and became a reasonable tennis player and played on the varsity at Oak Park High School. But the second thing that happened to me is that I saw in the public library an ad for a summer program at a private secondary school near Boston called Phillips Andover. And so this was giving preference not to African Americans, but to newspaper boys. That's the way since 1900 that Andover, which is a school where very many wealthy families send their boys, is the way they diversified their student body. And so I applied and was given that scholarship to go to Phillips Andover as a 16-year-old. So there I enjoyed enormously what that school had to offer. I could play sports on intramural teams. I could play basketball, touch football, and I could play on the varsity tennis team. And they gave me a scholarship to spend my whole senior year there. So that was an experience that really broadened my horizons, because it's a school that has the motto, youth from every quarter. So it isn't just this affirmative action quarter from which I came, but boys came from all over this country, but many other countries. There are diplomats, for example, working in Africa who would send their kids to Phillips Andover. So I got to meet a broad spectrum of people with a broad spectrum of experiences, and that started my way on toward enjoying not just the wilderness in Maine, but the the world at large and the different cultures in this world that I still enjoy. So that I describe this as the outcome of this second family tragedy that led me from Andover to 1 year as an exchange student in a school in England, a boarding school in England. And this school near to Cambridge, called Oundle, is in the same category as schools that you know much better here, such as Eton and Rugby and Harrow, these various schools. Oundle made itself different, an excellent, academically excellent school and only for boys, made itself different by a headmaster around 1900 called Sanderson. And what Sanderson insisted that these boys, many from wealthy families, must do is learn to work with their hands. So everybody had to take shop there and learn to work with a lathe and learn to work with a bandsaw and make stuff. And that helped me a lot going into science when I began in working in science. I could do my own glass blowing and make some of my own equipment during my early days as a scientist. Mm. So this school, Oundle, had a special flavor for its students and offered also the ability to get to know people who'd grown up, who lived in England. So the culture, as I recall it, of adolescence in this school in England, and it's something that I detect is still true among in the English society. It's important to have something unique about yourself that sets yourself apart. At that time in high school in this country, both in Oak Park and at Andover, it was important to be like everybody else. But there it was important to, this person had perfect pitch, or this person could remember the Aeneid for 10 minutes worth of reciting. He could had terrific memory. So each person had their own known talent. And what was my talent? Well, one was that because I'd become a reasonable tennis player, I could play tennis. And so I won the school championship, and they sent me to the school's championship at Wimbledon, which was a dream that I still savor, playing on grass at this hallowed tennis stadium in England, playing in the with other teenage schoolboys. But my other talent was I was still recognized as a good student, and I worked hard on the courses that I took, and then at the end of the school year passed a number of sort of advanced exams that are needed to get into Oxford and Cambridge. I passed five of them, and doing that allowed me then to skip my first year back in the States, back in college in the States. So just continuing that timeline, I went to college at Amherst College. I chose that because it was a place that had liberal arts. It was a small place where I felt I could interact with people more easily than in a larger university. For the first time in my life, I declined a major scholarship from Harvard. So the first time that I've declined to go to Harvard, and chose instead to go to a smaller place. And it was at Amherst that I was able to do experiments of my own, because its faculty, though a liberal arts college and an undergraduate college, its faculty included a number who had federal research grants in chemistry and in biology and in physics. And so I was able to work during the school year on projects that were funded by these well-established and faculty investigators. So one of these faculty who got to know me, a professor in biology, introduced me to that there was academia outside of New England. And so again, though I was accepted to Harvard's chemistry department and interviewed there and met with three distinguished professors and was kept waiting a full hour by each of them because they were extra busy, I recognized that Caltech out in Pasadena, though from my point of view, New England point of view, it was in the hinterlands, Caltech in Pasadena had the same level of excellence, was a small university that was in the at the leading edge in a number of sciences. But again, like Amherst was small, and so when I then became a graduate student in Caltech, I could learn the best science, and I could also move from chemistry toward biology. So I talked earlier in one of our previous sessions about the importance of Max Delbruck and the Phage group and how he could gather together people out of the physical sciences into the biological sciences. And so I was able to make that transition while I was at Caltech, in large part because it was a small, much more personal, but cutting edge research place. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you how you financed your undergraduate career?
Well, all along, every step of the way, I was given full scholarships. Mm-hmm. So at Amherst, I was funded by a Sloan Foundation scholarship. And at Caltech, I was funded by a National Science Foundation fellowship. So, you know, doing science is a fairly solitary business, and, you know, at a place like Caltech, you work, you follow your own urge, and you work sometimes late at night or early in the morning, many hours. Mm-hmm. My research professor, Norma Davidson, was a very personable, interactive person. And he'd gone to the University of Chicago and been a Rhodes Scholar. So we shared an enjoyment of the English style of life. And he encouraged me to become a dorm dad during my third year at Caltech after I had really established my thesis. And so I became the sort of so-called resident associate in one of the undergraduate houses at Caltech. It was a house called Blacker House, right on the campus. And it's when I was dorm dad that I met Dick Burgess, who was a freshman in a different house. But we, at the beginning of the fall term, we had a sort of a retreat where the new freshmen would meet all of the dorm dads. So I got to meet Dick at the beginning of his career. Being a dorm dad in a Caltech undergraduate house is eye-opening, mind-opening. These students are so brilliant. And if you think you're bright, you better visit one of these houses. And there are people 10 times as bright as you are. Mm-hmm. But being bright doesn't necessarily mean well-balanced. So it takes maturity to interact with a person who's really bright but doesn't really know how to control himself, mm-hmm. and can be dangerous because he's so bright. These are students who like to play tricks on others. It was while I was at Caltech that their famous Rose Bowl trick was played on the whole television audience. What they managed to do was, during the Rose Bowl, they managed to change the cheering section. I think it was for UCLA, when they held up their cards that said UCLA or hooray for UCLA, the cards came up Caltech instead, just by changing all of the codes in this cheering section. And they were really, this student body was loved to play pranks on others like that. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was eye-opening to see how this group of very bright people could interact with each other and to try to then work with mm-hmm. a person who's extra bright to help them become a citizen. Mm-hmm. So just, I'm near the end of this timeline, and my connection through the Delbruck with the Phage group, and beginning to learn how to study simple biological problems through genetics to combine it with the chemistry that I knew and loved. I was lucky to get a postdoc position at the Medical Research Council in Cambridge, England, at the very time that this was blossoming as the really place at which much of contemporary molecular biology was developed in the early 60s. So these are people that now seem rather like gods: Francis Crick, Sidney Brenner, Max Perutz, all of them Nobel Prize winners. They seem like gods at this distance, but they are just people with their own idiosyncrasies, their own foibles, but all brilliant and analyzing biological problems in a new way that I could certainly appreciate. So my time at MRC Cambridge was formative, but not fruitful. I did not publish more than one paper in the year and a half that I was there. But I did develop a vision of what I wanted to do. So a brilliant geneticist, the one who really helped me appreciate genetics, his name is Sidney Brenner. And during my year, he'd spent a vacation with another brilliant geneticist from the Pasteur Institute named François Jacob. And the two of them had developed a model for how replication is controlled. It's a model called the replicon model. And it had very definite genetic predictions, molecular predictions that could begin to be tested. I went to one conference during that year in Brussels, organized by a brilliant Belgian geneticist named René Thomas. And René Thomas had presented a paper that challenged the replicon model. So this was a terrific situation to see two contrasting sets of ideas that didn't agree strictly with one another, and they needed to be resolved. And so I had a vision of a way to resolve that paradox. So more importantly, and on this part of the timeline, and we will get to people, that I shared a laboratory with Alexander Shadlovsky, who was also a postdoctoral fellow. Just as an aside, early 60s, are what we call the post-Sputnik era. In the post-Sputnik era, the U.S. wanted to catch up scientifically with the rest of the world, because Sputnik illustrated that we were behind. And so there were a lot of fellowships given, postdoctoral fellowships for Americans. And it didn't matter if you were studying overseas, if you were going overseas to learn something that was new. So both Alexander and I had postdoc fellowships to work in England. And so we shared a laboratory. So I got to know her well during that time. And not just for the science and a mutual interest in points, issues in science, but also because I sometimes get really interested in something, and the style of life in the English laboratories is to have morning coffee, lunch, and tea, and talk about point science of interest. So sometimes my experiment would be, or the auger I was melting would continue to boil, but Alexander was always there to rescue my experiment. So that's important to learn about your life companion, that they're ready to rescue any way that you might fall short of doing what you wanted to do. So that timeline, then passing through Cambridge, came to looking for a job, having published just from my postdoc just one short paper, but knowing what I wanted to do. So I then made a trip across the country, gave perhaps 6 different job interviews, was given a number of job offers, including again one from the Harvard Medical School and one from the University of Oregon and places in between. So on a January day, January 17th of 94, I visited Madison. It was cold, and I met Harold Rush, and we talked about that earlier in this series of oral history sessions. And my lab wasn't ready. When I accepted this position, my lab wasn't ready, wouldn't be ready for some time. So I chose to accept the offer from the Stanford Biochemistry Department for a place vacated by a sabbatical faculty member, Dale Kaiser, who also worked on Lambda and understood what I wanted to do. He gave me a position, his lab, and access to his technician, and a colleague who was also a postdoctoral fellow in that lab, Vernon Bode, who ended up in the University of Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. So Vernon and I developed a number of scientific mutual interests, and ironically, he's the other person in this country who developed ENU mutagenesis of the mouse germline at the same time that Alexander and I did at Wisconsin. And it was these research universities in the Midwest where one could do these experiments with mice without having to pay huge per diems, which you have to pay when you're on the coast, because real estate costs much more on the coasts. So Vernon and I discovered the power of ENU totally in parallel, but I'd say that our outlook was formed by the time we spent together as postdocs, or in my case, I was a visiting researcher in Stanford. Mm-hmm. So then the rest is what we have been talking about in McArdle, UW-Madison, Madison community. So now, that's a timeline. I'd like to end that timeline by speaking of today. So in this history, we talked about 2 family tragedies when my dad lost his job twice. But he never gave up his real interest and enthusiasm for ideas and doing experiments to test those ideas. So during my teenage, he did not have a job. He did experiments at home, testing the taste sensitivity of different members of our family for different kinds of flavors and so on, and publishing some papers, but strictly from home. He was not bitter. He just wanted to keep pursuing his ideas, and luckily my mother kept the family in bread and butter. Mm-hmm. Today, I was in my lab. I talked with each of my two graduate students. Mm-hmm. I worked on something that our researcher, Linda Clipson, had put together for us. And I'm so grateful. Mm-hmm. And McArdle has given me a chance to keep working as much as I want, which is essentially my regular days. Mm-hmm. Half day on Saturday, the regular schedule on Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for every single day of that. And so I hope I've given you a sense of why I'm particularly grateful. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the end of timeline. Ends with today. Hopefully we'll continue.
Can I cycle back just a little bit to talk just a touch more about your father? I know he studied genetics here at UW.
Right.
When did he graduate?
So he came off a farm in Iowa, wanted to learn how to improve cattle, quality of cattle. He had been a prize-winning cattle judge in college at Iowa State. This was the leading genetics department. It was the first genetics department. It's called experimental breeding, but it became genetics when that became a word to be used. And so he became a graduate student with L.J. Cole, who was interested in cattle breeding here. And there, they were not training grants. He got some money working as a lab tech for Steenbach in biochemistry. Did some cabinet making. He was handy doing cabinet making. Still had very little money, so he lived out near Picnic Point year-round. And this is a tale that I tell to the graduate students when they begin to complain about their stipend or about the cold. He simply built a good wind-breaking lean-to, made his meals over a fire or over a Bunsen burner in the lab, and wrote in his journal that he much preferred sleeping out of doors at minus 20 when all he had to have was a good sleeping bag to plus 90 when he had to fight off the mosquitoes and the humidity, which is harder to deal with than the minus 20. So anyway, he lived living outdoors and survived and got a PhD then in something like 4 years from 1923 to 1927, after which he then went to the University of Maine. He always savored his time as a graduate student. And when he turned 70, we all organized a set of tapes sent to him by his colleagues who had been graduate students together with him. And I still remember the great pleasure. You know, this was a time he'd lost his job and all of that. He wasn't able to take pride in some awards or anything like that. He took pride in these personal friendships that he made as a graduate student. And I'll tell you, that's been a main incentive for my wanting to help graduate programs here, because I know this is a great place to be a graduate student. So the effort I was offered to help out in a graduate program was that in genetics. So I spent 13 years leading the genetics doctoral program, and I think I can say without being too proud that I think it really consolidated itself into really the most cohesive graduate program that I know. The word is that you can tell a graduate student in genetics if you meet them on the street because they're smiling. This is a group that really gets together and supports one another and benefits from the diversity that they come maybe 10 a year on campus and end up everywhere. So when I first took over the program, they ended up everywhere and never saw each other. But now, they end up everywhere and yet see each other on a regular basis by having a core curriculum and having the summer colloquia being given by the students, and they all come to hear their colleagues give their research talks in front of all of the faculty. So it's a whole sense of community that they have. I do hope that I can help the cancer biology reach that level of community. So anyway, that is a bit about my father's relationship with the university. And I think it segues into what you asked me to talk about, UW-Madison, other places that have made offers to us to work elsewhere. So with places that are important, and UW-Madison is at the center of it, I talked about the importance of MRC Cambridge, and indeed I've gone back there, importance of the Pasteur Institute, François Jacob in particular, where we learned a lot of mouse genetics by having a sabbatical there. Importance of Stanford's biochemistry department that gave me a spot to work while my lab was made ready here. Importance of Caltech, all of this outside, but it is all for in my mind and in my heart centered around UW-Madison. Now part of that feeling, I'm sure, comes from my father's experience here and then how much he enjoyed his time here. Part of it comes from learning the difference between academia in New England and academia in Caltech and the California culture. And Madison, to me, was the right median between those two extremes. With California, the sense of neighborhood was absent. People were coming and going all of the time. Pasadena was a bit of an exception, but anywhere else, it was just too much turnover and too much pushing the envelope of ways to live, too much experimentation, whereas Madison was a place that, I'll just finish with California, the academics were much less hierarchical. I could move from department to department, and it wasn't the way it was in New England. So Madison was the happy medium. The departments are open to one another. My students have learned methods in other departments. I haven't had to sign some big contract to work for my students to learn something in another department. And Wisconsin put most of its colleges in one town, unlike New York or California. So because science changes, I say it pretty much every 7 years, the science is totally different. Science changes, so the ability to learn new things, it would always be represented somewhere on the Madison campus, not necessarily in your department, but somewhere you could learn whatever is needed to do to address the new scientific problem that became interesting. So the neighborhoods in Madison and the nature of the UW campus were a happy medium for me. I mentioned a little while ago also that we could develop mouse genetics here because per diems for mice was much more easy to manage on a grant than would be the case on the coasts. If I was faculty at Stanford explored the possibility of my working there, UCSF, UC San Francisco, and the same with Boston, that there for me to carry out the research we wanted to do would have been at least twofold or threefold more expensive. We'd have to get that many more grants to support it. So Madison was ideal for A, doing the new work we wanted to do, and B, the many different departments that we came to interact with. Some of the alternatives where we've been offered positions are in the state universities like Stony Brook or UCLA, where, again, the problem that I've mentioned is that these are campuses that are separated away geographically from other disciplines. So in California, all of veterinary medicine is done in Davis. And New York State has at least four different major research campuses, no one of which has everything that Madison has. I've not been offered a position in Michigan, but Michigan is also a split state in regard to their agriculture being done at East Lansing and their letters in science and physics, biology in Ann Arbor. All right, so anyway, these places I talked about, the outside places, I didn't mention one that we continue to interact with, and that is the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine. And that has had a long-term attraction and interaction with us. I was once asked to become its director, which I declined because I wanted to do mostly research. But the Jackson Lab has this long-term commitment to mouse biology and mouse genetics. It's not on a campus the way McArdle is on a campus. So it's somewhat compromised in that way, and a little hard to support graduate students and postdocs in the Jackson Lab. But nonetheless, they've supported a number of independent investigators. And it being in the state of Maine, it has that flavor that I grew up with. I do remember in my childhood going down to the coast, especially summers. Mm. And I'll tell you that the site in which the Jackson Lab is situated is a national park called Acadia. And so it hasn't changed greatly. And furthermore, the residents of that island, Mount Desert Island, refuse to allow there to be a McDonald's and any of the chains that homogenize other cities, including Madison. Mm. So it does not change. And when you two get much older, I can tell you that to go to a place that 70 years later looks the same would really be special, and that is the impact that going to Mount Desert Island and the Jackson Lab has on me. It's a place that is still beautiful and hasn't changed, hasn't been degraded. So that is an outside place that we continue to relate to. But the center of our life is in Madison and its neighborhoods and schools and friendships. Mm. So that moves to people.
So I know you've You spoke in a prior session about some of your some of the faculty members at McArdle who were friends with you and your family. Do you want to speak more about them and how that relationship got started?
Well, so the people with whom we've had continuing family connections, who are also on the McArdle faculty, are Dick and Ann Burgess, whose two children are somewhat younger than our three children, but by, I guess, 4 or 5 years younger, they are that much younger than we are. But we shared a number of family events, Christmas events. We occasionally hosted a McArdle faculty and staff Christmas, and a year later Dick and Ann did the same thing. So we've had a sort of commitment to McArdle as a family, trying to follow in the style that Harold Rush really implemented, a style that has fallen away in this newer version, the more community version of, that McArdle exists in now. With Bill Sugden and his wife Donata, we've had a family inclusive relationship. And this in part includes our dog, Ginger. Whenever we'd go off to Maine, it was Bill and Donata who'd be willing to take Ginger, because they too love dogs. And it came to be such that Ginger would be sad to leave the Sugdens when we came home. He very much enjoyed their company and their dog, because they had a dog. So that was a plus for Ginger. They've been supportive and understanding of the growth of our three kids and their son Arthur, who again was somewhat younger. He's just passing through graduate school right now. Their son Arthur has followed a similar path as our middle son Patrick, who's the one who's in academia. Their son Arthur is following an academic path now. So in Madison, I would say that our strongest family connections are through families to whom we connected through our kids, our children, going to school, and some of that involving volunteering, PTSO, which Alexandra has done a great deal of, and getting to know the parents of peers of our kids. All of this is part of the strength of the Madison neighborhoods, that throughout we felt that getting to know the parents of our kids' friends makes for a very secure fabric. If you know the parents, then you know something about what the kids are doing or not doing, or what their problems are. And so you know a bit more about the strengths and risks of the friendships that your kids are building up. So we live in an area that has a neighborhood school, and now our two grandchildren who live in Madison are going to that same school that our own kids went to, and Alexandra has been volunteering, and I gave a talk with her at the neighborhood school.
Which school is it?
It's called Thoreau on Nakoma Road near Seminole Highway. And this is a school that we continue to interact with, even though as grandparents. But our two kids, Suzanne and her husband, Miguel, do a lot with the school, go to the school events, and our two grandchildren now go to that school. And that school now is more than a neighborhood school because of busing. it includes a number of minority kids who come from South Madison or Arbor Drive, and so it's a different equation, but it still illustrates the importance of peer interactions among kids to develop, to really grow. And I think the new makeup of Thoreau School is even more diverse and therefore more meaningful for our grandchildren. So, you know, the friendships that we have, a lot of them have grown up out of our kids and schools that they've gone to. Some have grown up more later out of missions that Alexander and I have taken on after our kids have grown up and gone off, because they're now all of them are in their 40s. They were born between 66 and 69. I'm talking 1966 and 1969. They are all young adults, parents. Mm-hmm. But so we have some of our own missions that we spend time and effort with, and one of them is the American Players Theater in Spring Green. And we were present at the birth of that theater and present at its near-death event 7 years later, when the brilliant founding trio, of whom one was a brilliant actor, had just given their all and they had to quit. They had put everything into it, including some of their own funds. They had to quit. But by 7 years, they had such a following that Alexandra and others and I all went out to the Guard Theater in Spring Green, where they were giving their sayonaras, and said, "No, you need $200,000 to keep going this season. We'll raise it." And it was raised in 2 weeks by this group of about 15 friends of APT, so that the exhausted trio couldn't stop. They kept going. They lasted a couple more years, but by then grants were brought, arts development grants from the state and other things were brought to bear, and the theater survived this near-death experience. And Alexandra and I, less intimately, but certainly actively supporting what now, after 33 years, has been in the black for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. So that's been a theatrical interest that we've put effort into, and some of our own friendships now are related to that. People who go with us to APT, but also a play reading group that we have for the last 15 years of seven couples that enjoy the theater. So again, Madison community allows that. Other communities do too, but in Madison you can do that while busily working, because you don't have to spend a lot of time commuting. So that sentence then connects to part of our family. So much of our present travels, for example, what we're doing this coming weekend, has to do with family. There's a nephew getting married out in California, and we're going to support that. Mm-hmm. Our youngest, mm-hmm, Suzanne, mm-hmm, became spread her wings, became natively fluent in Spanish, induced herself a job in Barcelona. There she met her husband, Miguel. McGill, also in Spanish academia, found that as a young faculty member, he had to do all the jobs. So they moved to Washington, D.C., where he had better opportunities, and she worked for the World Bank. So again, very international. But then when they had children, they decided they would rather not spend an hour each day commuting each way to their jobs. They'd rather live in a smaller city, and they chose Madison, where they each are working actively. McGill for a company in D.C., but mostly working at home, and Suzanne working for the university, the School of Business, but able to bike to work, 15 minutes to work, able to go to the support things that their children do at the neighborhood school, all of that. So that all speaks for the what Madison has to offer in terms of the lifestyle that the people we know like to lead.
So I'd like to ask you about Grandparents University. Are you also involved with that? So why did you get involved and what have you been doing with it?
Well, so our other two children live far from Madison. Our eldest in Princeton, New Jersey, and our middle in Bloomington, Illinois, Bloomington, Indiana. And so we travel to see them. But now that our eldest grandson from New Jersey is eligible for a grandparent university, we've hosted him back here. And it's been his first time to fly on his own, which is a great thrill for him, for Lewis. So he came a year ago, and I was his, with Grandparent University, there has to be one grandparent per grandchild. So I was his companion, and we took a major, this is essentially a two-day event. The major that we took was limnology. And again, one of our neighbors, who's an emeritus professor of limnology, John Magnuson, led this event. We went out on Lake Mendota and began to study some of the biology and physics that would go on. And is it true that the water is not blue? How come when you pick it up it's clear, it's not blue? All of those questions that we addressed, and they were very good undergraduate discussion leaders who would have the grandchildren sitting around a table, and they would sit on the outside, and the discussion was all pretty much carried by the kids with their own thoughts and interactions with one another. It was an example of what I call peer education, with these undergraduate facilitators just filling a few gaps in the discussion. Well, we decided to continue that. So this year, our elder grandson, who's now 13, chose cartography, and I was again his companion. And this is a great resource in the geology department, which is in Science Hall, a really old, dilapidated science building, but with a terrific resource of maps. And with this new science of cartography, which is really important for almost everything we do. On the negative side, it's what the politicians use. They can take the map of Wisconsin and put on it what the average household income is in any one neighborhood and decide how to gerrymander the voting districts in order to facilitate their outcome. Mm-hmm. But it's also useful on the cloud. You can get various weather patterns. You can put those on top of a map. They're just great application of maps to your everyday life. So he and I studied cartography and looked at the resources that geography department has put together. In parallel, the only granddaughter in our family, Miranda, living in Madison, went with Alexandra to Grandparent University. because she's just 8, she couldn't get her top choice, which was theater. She couldn't get her top choice. She got her fourth choice, which was restoration ecology, which took place in the Arboretum, and you learned something about invasive species and how to clear them out and various ways in which the Arboretum tries to establish and maintain natural communities, plant communities. In that case, because during the week that we talk about, it rained on one of the 2 days. It had to be indoors, and so wasn't quite as, they had to use Plan B a lot, whereas their cartography was pretty much all indoors and used Plan A. It's the plan that they had wanted to use was used. Mm-hmm. But I believe that Miranda will continue to want to attend, and our other 5 grandchildren are coming up to wanting to participate. So this is a way that brings our family this direction.
Well, that's all my questions. Thank you very much for your time.